And we'll move to the fourth case of the morning. It's number 081183, Terry versus Hulick. Mr. Skidmore.
May it please the court. My name is Greg Skidmore, and I represent the petitioner, Mr. Melky Terry. Your Honors, this case has a complex procedural history, but the issue before the court is straightforward. Was the federal habeas petition filed by Mr. Terry in 2006 timely under AEDPA? The answer to that question is yes. Mr. Terry filed his original federal habeas petition in 1992. The district court dismissed the petition without prejudice for failure to exhaust state court remedies in 1995. Mr. Terry proceeded on his first state post-conviction petition until October 5, 1998. At that point, his one-year clock under AEDPA started and ran for 278 days until Mr. Terry filed his second state post-conviction petition on July 11, 1999. That petition was dismissed on the merits on December 1, 2005. At that point, Mr. Terry had 87 days remaining in his one-year period. He filed his renewed federal habeas petition on day 83, February 23, 2006. In this appeal, the state has called into question the tolling effect of both of the state post-conviction petitions. What this appeal is really about is about the second state post-conviction petition. This petition was filed on July 11, 1999. Now, the district court used a different date. It used September 2, 1999. And this had the effect of reducing Mr. Terry's AEDPA period by approximately 2 months.
Well, there is there's that mistake in the district court's decision. But there is a question about that first post-conviction proceeding in the Illinois state courts and when it became final. And this is the subject of an exchange of letters recently received by the court on Illinois law in that regard. And it's my understanding that a petition for rehearing or a motion for rehearing in the state Supreme Court in Illinois is entertained by the court, and if it's denied, the effective date of the court's judgment is the original decision. If it's granted, then the effective date becomes the date that that motion is, the case is reheard and decided. And so there's a question about whether the pendency of one of those motions for rehearing in the state Supreme Court means that the state post-conviction proceeding is still pending for purposes of the AEDPA tolling provision.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm happy to address that point. First, I'll just note for the court that the court need not consider the argument raised on Friday in a purported 28J letter by the state, because it relies on cases that are not new authority. And as this court has held, Rule 28J does not permit a litigant to raise brand new arguments for the first time that aren't raised either in the district court or even in the brief to this court.
Right, but we've got to try to count the days right.
Absolutely. I understand, Your Honor. And on the merits, the issue is more complicated than the state would have the court believe in its 350-word letter. There's at least three complications here. The first is the intervening Supreme Court case in Lawrence versus Florida. Lawrence versus Florida makes clear that 2244D2 focuses not on the effective date of the judgment or the finality of the judgment, but whether the state petition remains pending. Put another way, whether there's still an avenue for relief in the state court. And a petition for rehearing is still an avenue for relief in the state court. Indeed, Lawrence explicitly distinguishes 2244D1, which runs from, quote, the date on which the judgment became final, and 2244D2, which is what's relevant here, which does not use that language, and instead asks whether the state petition is still pending. Now, Congress, if they wanted to run both D1 and D2 from finality, could have used the same language and would have used the same language, but it didn't. It didn't run D2 from the date the judgment became final. It ran it depending on whether or not the state petition is pending. Now, second, there's a question in Illinois about whether this court's precedent accurately reflects the current state of Illinois law on finality. Both Jones v. Hulick and Gilden cite back not to any Illinois cases, but only to the Wilson v. Battles case, which is this court's opinion in 2002, which first adopted this rule. Now, Wilson, in turn, cites only PSL Realty, which is a 1981 Illinois Supreme Court case that talks about the effective date of the judgment. Importantly, Wilson was decided before People v. Brown. People v. Brown is a 2002 Illinois Supreme Court case that was decided after Wilson. And Wilson and People v. Brown clarifies a distinction in Illinois law between the effective date of the judgment and whether or not the judgment is final. What People v. Brown says is, regardless of what the effective date of the judgment is or will be, the judgment itself is not final until the petition for rehearing in the Illinois Supreme Court is denied. And third, the Jones v. Hulick line of cases may arguably violate the Supreme Court's decision in Carey v. Saffold, which is a 2002 decision. What's important to note is that the Illinois Supreme Court rule, Rule 367, which is the basis of the Jones v. Hulick line of cases, applies not only to the Illinois Supreme Court, but also to the intermediate Illinois appellate courts. So what this means is that if the petition for rehearing in the Illinois Supreme Court does not toll the AEDPA period, then the petition for rehearing in the Illinois intermediate appellate courts also don't toll the petition for rehearing. Toll the AEDPA period on a petition for rehearing. But this is a problem, because this means that a petitioner in state court would have his AEDPA period begin to run before he has completed a full round of review in the state courts, because during the pendency of the petition for rehearing in the Illinois Intermediate Appellate Court, the AEDPA period would already begin to run. And this goes against the Supreme Court's ruling in Carey v. Saffold. At the end of the day, this is a very complicated issue, and again, we urge the court not to consider it. But if the court is going to consider it, we would ask if the court asked for supplemental briefing and not decide the issue on the basis of 350-word letters. But again, the main issue here is the state of the second state petition. And Mr. Terry put in evidence in the district court that it's July 11, 1999, and September 2, 1999. And under that date, his AEDPA petition was timely. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so if the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Redfern.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Charles Redfern from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of Respondent Warden. We ask the court to affirm the judgment because the petition is untimely in this case. Additionally, petitioner is not entitled to a reconstruing of the 1995 dismissal without prejudice. And finally, petitioner has failed to argue a constitutional claim in his opening brief. To pick up on the issue of the timeliness first, our position is that the first PC was not properly filed, so it did not toll at all. But if it did toll, and to continue the conversation from the point here, it is that the entry of the judgment by the Illinois Supreme Court, petitioner is incorrect in his citations to People v. Brown. Brown has to deal with the issue. In Brown, what happened was the petitioner argued, the question was whether the prisoner could bring a rehearing at that point. And what Brown was saying was that the Illinois Supreme Court still has jurisdiction until the mandate is issued. The court is done under Illinois Rule 367 with the case. It has reached finality in the case. And specifically under Carey v. Saffold, it's achieved final resolution through state courts. That's 536 U.S. at 220. So the case has completed in the state court upon the entry of the judgment. And so Jones v. Hulick, Gilden v. Bowen, as well as Wilson v. Battles is correct. Additionally, Lawrence v. Florida doesn't change the situation here. To point out, this court was on the proper side of the split in Lawrence. It went under Gutierrez v. Schmonig, which the court essentially affirmed. And in Jones v. Hulick, it cites the Gutierrez. So if there was any intervening change in the law, with Lawrence, that would be incorrect because the law stayed the same. The language that petitioner takes out of context out of Lawrence is this one sentence about the entry of the mandate. That is, it appears, where the Supreme Court was determining when a judgment is final in Florida. But under Illinois Supreme Court Rule 367 and the cases that this court has held on numerous times, it is correct that the judgment is entered at the time of the opinion, and that is when it's final. To put this back in the context of the dates, that means that the Illinois Supreme Court was done considering the case in June 18, 1998, and more than a year would run until the July 11, 1999 mailing date.
Under the Illinois precedents, and in particular the People versus Brown case, yes, the pendency of a motion for rehearing means that the decision is not final.
Even though
if the court denies that motion, the effective date is the original date of the entry of judgment. It's a strange kind of a rule, but it is what it is.
And Jones cites a case, PSL Realty Company, which is also an Illinois Supreme Court case from 1981. It does not specifically overrule that case. It actually cites it as supporting authority. PSL Realty, which presents this rule, is what is cited by Wilson v. Battles. And so what Jones looks to be saying is simply, when Jones said, I wish to bring a petition for rehearing, and so the question in Jones was whether the court had jurisdiction to hear the petition for rehearing. I understand there's language in Jones that says we aren't finished with the case yet because, i.e., we can hear a petition for rehearing.
You mean Brown people?
Brown said that, yes. However, the Illinois Supreme Court is clear both in PSL Realty as well as Rule 367. And in the plain language of Illinois Rule 367, it says judgment. The judgment is the last act of the court. So the mandate is not the judgment under the language of the plain language of the Illinois Supreme Court rules. And to think of it within the policy of 2244D2, the purpose of going back and tolling is to ensure that the federal claims have been exhausted. It's been exhausted through the issuance of the decision. You don't need to bring a petition for rehearing to exhaust. So it would not further the policy of requiring exhaustion to say that the petitioner need to bring a petition for rehearing. Now, we understand it's a question of Illinois law ultimately, and we think that the Brown case is talking about when we can reconsider the case. But it's Illinois Rule 367, so Jones v. Hulick is correct. Just one final note before I move off this point. Petitioner is incorrect when he says this wouldn't make sense in the appellate court. If a decision is entered in the appellate court, the prisoner can then bring a petition for leave to appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court, and that time period for bringing the petition for leave to appeal would be counted in the tolling. So that's how he gets this tolling in that situation. If I can move to the point I brought before about how the first PC does not toll at all, the fact is that it was dismissed as untimely. Now, petitioner argues that the first PC, that adequate and independent state law basis was undone by the fact that the Illinois Supreme Court dealt with the merits determination. However, the Illinois Supreme Court specifically dealt with an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. Under Illinois law, the question was whether a sentence exceeded the statutory maximum, which is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. And the procedural history, what happened here is that issue was raised in the first time on appeal. And the way that you know this is because a post-conviction petition raises constitutional claims. And so if the state Supreme Court did deal with the merits of the post-conviction petition, you would see constitutional analysis, for example, Strickland. There's no Strickland analysis here. There is no constitutional analysis here. Now, yes, a state proceeding, a state law claim could toll under D2 if it is brought under a properly filed application for post-conviction or other state proceeding. However, here, the only properly filed application for post-conviction proceeding or collateral review was the post-conviction petition. And under that's Artuse v. Bennett from the U.S. Supreme Court. And Artuse is very clear to point out that there cannot be this 50-50 or half tolling, half not tolling. It is either properly filed by the state court or it's not. In this situation, the fact that it was dismissed, that is the only proceeding here, and that proceeding was not properly filed. Finally, and just as a quick point to hit the second PC, because the first PC does not toll, or even if it does toll, it can't pass June of 1998, Escamilla v. Jungwirth says that a later post-conviction petition has no tolling effect once the statute of limitations is run. We understand Well, to be very clear about this, we always raised since day one in this court, in the district court, that the petition was untimely. We asserted the procedural defense. Yes, there were issues about the analysis, but I think it is an accurate statement to say that, to take the phrase from Your Honor, we're trying to count the days right. We're trying to put the proper information before this court. It is the judgment before this court. This court can affirm, even though the district court got to the wrong, used an improper analysis, she got to the right result. And we ask Your Honors to recognize that proper result. If I can quickly touch on the stay issue, here, the whole idea of the 1995 dismissal, what the district court said is, I see that it's untimely. However, I want to say it's untimely. There was a later a dismissal without prejudice in 1995, and then I see later it's untimely. That doesn't mean that the petitioner was in need of a protective stay. That is not the situation of the protective stay that Pace versus DiBiglio and Rines v. Weber are talking about. A protective stay, and the key word is protective. That's what I would want Your Honors to focus on. I'd recommend not focusing on. In 1995, there was no statute of limitations. It would not make sense to protect a prisoner from a then non-existent statute of limitations. For district court to say, I forecast in the future there will be untimeliness. Therefore, I am now going to protect someone from something that does not exist. This situation, which is talked about in Dulles and Arrieta, is in Newell, which petitioner specifically focuses on, is a situation where the petitioner brings a federal petition. His one-year period has run because the filing of the federal petition does not toll the statute of limitations. That's Duncan v. Walker. And then the only thing protecting him is the fact that he filed this petition. So to dismiss without prejudice, he would lose that protective effect, and that would make his petition untimely. What you need to focus on, or what we recommend you focusing on, is the fact that at the time of the dismissal, whether that would make his petition untimely. Here in this case, at the time of the petition, there was no concern. He could have come back to federal court. He could have told. He could have said, I am confused. I see these new cases coming up. He never asserted any reasonable confusion about the timeliness of his petition. He says, my case is just like Newell. Newell was passed. It was issued by this court in 2002. He never came back and asked about that. It was the district court. Finally, we point this court to Anderson v. Lister as well as Beyer v. Lister, which says that if the petitioner does not argue a constitutional claim in his opening brief, any error in the statute of limitations is ultimately harmless. It's a general harmless error principle. Whether the district court was correct or not, at the end of the day, it's a question of whether he's being held in violation of his constitutional rights. He's never said that. The court certified both constitutional and non-constitutional issues here. It certified ineffective assistance of counsel, among others. He never argued those. So at the end of the day, even if the district court is wrong and it is timely, that error is harmless, because he has never argued before this court is required under Anderson v. Lister that he is being held in violation of his constitutional rights.
Well, he did assert that, and we noted that in the CA that we granted on April 28th of last year, but the order may have been misleading because it ordered briefing only on the procedural question, and that's on us. That's not on the petitioner.
I see my time's expired. May I respond? There's two points here. One is, we cited in our motion to clarify, I understand the motion to clarify was denied, but we cited in the motion to clarify that a CA cannot be issued without the issuance of both constitutional and non-constitutional issues. We put in Young versus the United States. So he was clearly shown that you need a constitutional issue. And then Your Honor's order, only just in a one-sentence statement, said it was denied. So that he had actual notice, in fact, that there is a need for constitutional and non-constitutional issues.
He was told, as a matter of judicial economy, to brief, in this oral argument at least, simply the procedural issues. I mean, given this bizarre case, doesn't it make a lot of sense for the court to want to hear oral argument on the procedural issues first and figure out whether we need to reach the substance or not? The district court never reached the substance.
I'm not going to tread too heavily here. If Your Honors feel that it was misleading, then if Your Honors construe it to say only non-constitutional, then I'm not going to push heavier there. All I'm saying is this court has clear case law that says, by definition, a CA cannot be issued without constitutional issues, and
that's not the nature of the flaw in this CA. The CA did note constitutional issues. It just contained a misleading briefing order.
Okay.
Or at least potentially misleading.
Of all things, at this point, I'm trying to preserve my arguments. So.
Thank you.
I appreciate your patience. Thank you. We ask you affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Skidmore, how much time? You have 2 minutes.
Your Honors, importantly, the state doesn't say anything in its argument about the July date for the second state petition. And so really what it's trying to do is focus on the first state petition. And the state completely has waived all of those arguments. And I understand that this court has the power to excuse waiver, but it shouldn't do so in this case when in the district court, when the whole issue was timeliness, the state specifically stated that the first petition was properly filed and then it told the AEDPA period until October 5th, 1998. That's on page A143 of the appendix. And moreover, the argument today has underscored that if the court is going to consider the issue, we would urge it to order supplemental briefing because it's a complicated issue and we would like the chance to expand on it beyond a 350-word letter. But again, Your Honors, on the substance of the new issue raised on Friday, you have to read People v. Brown and PSL Realty, the two Illinois Supreme Court cases, together. And reading them together, it's clear that for finality under Illinois law, it's determined on when the petition for rehearing is denied. Now, the effective date of that judgment may be the day of the opinion, but finality is determined by the denial of the petition for rehearing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. And, Mr. Skidmore, you were appointed counsel in this case. Is that correct? You have the thanks of the court for your service to your client and the court.
Thank you.
And our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.